Chapter 61. The Major watched the grey Vauxhall Vectra drive away from Wellington Barracks. The two MI5 officers were in the front, and Zack was in the back, sandwiched between Travis and Wheeler. They had zip-cuffed his wrists despite his protests, though they had agreed that his hands could be bound in front of him. The American was ashen-faced, clearly worried about what lay ahead of him. But the Major had zero sympathy for him. He had made his bed, and now he was going to have to lie in it, bloody sheets and all. He took out his phone and called Mark Rennie, immediately apologising for the time of his call.
"So I just need to pick your brains again," he said to the former Sergeant Major, "specifically about his time in Colombia."
"Not sure I can help you there, boss," said Rennie. "That was after I'd left."
"Can you think of anyone who might be able to fill me in?"
"Let me check and I'll call you back," said Rennie. "Presumably you want to talk to someone who was out there with him."
"That's exactly what I want, Mark," said Gannon. "Soon as you can, will you? I'm on a ticking clock here."
"I'll make some calls, boss."
The Major ended the call and put the phone away. He needed caffeine, so headed for the officer's mess and ordered a coffee and a club sandwich. He ran through his conversation with Zack as he chewed on his sandwich. Zack had said 13 men had flown in from the States. Presumably, Javier had reported back that Flores had been caught in the MI5 sting, and Martinez had sent out reinforcements. Four of the team had been tasked with kidnapping Hurst's family, and three of them were now dead. The rest of the team had presumably gone to the Wimbledon house with Hurst, and the same team had then attacked the safe house in Hampstead. He sipped his coffee. Six had died at Hampstead. Another had died along with the MI5 officer and two SAS troopers on the abortive attempt to collect Sally Page. So 10 out of 13 were dead. Zack was in custody. That meant there were still two out there, plus Marty Hurst. Presumably, the cartel was still determined to get to the informant, which meant they would need more manpower. There wouldn't be time to fly in reinforcements from the States, so they would have to use locals. His phone rang and he picked it up. It was Rennie.
"Boss, do you know Colin Peckham? He's with B Squadron."
"Del Boy, sure."
Colin Peckham had only fools and horses to thank for his nickname, Peckham being the area of London associated with its main character.
"That's him. Anyway, Del Boy was with Hurst in Colombia. I thought it best you talk to him direct, so I've told him to expect your call. Is that okay?"
"That's perfect, Mark. Thanks."
"I'll text you his number."
The Major thanked him and ended the call. A few seconds later, his phone buzzed with a message containing Peckham's number. Del Boy was a 15-year veteran of the SAS, a forward air control specialist. He had extensive training in calling in aircraft to attack ground targets, a skill he had used to good effect in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. He was a good, solid operator, and the Major had used him on several occasions for operations carried out by the increment. FAC specialists had to perform well under pressure, as any mistake could result in civilian casualties. He called the number, but it went through to voicemail. He left a short message, just saying who was calling and that it was urgent. The man was clearly screening his calls, because within 30 seconds, he rang back.
"Sorry about that, boss, but my ex-wife has set lawyers on me."
"Sorry to hear that," said Gannon.
"Alimony? She's trying to get blood out of a stone. But what can you do? My first wife gets the lion's share of my paycheck, because we've got two kids. Anyway, my problems are my problems. What do you need?"
"Guy called Marty Hurst. You were in Colombia with him."
"Ah, has he got himself into trouble again?"
"Again?"
"He was a bloody Jonah. Bad luck follows him around."
"Bad luck or bad judgment?" Peckham laughed.
"Well, Marty would always say he was unlucky. But yeah, he made more than his fair share of bad calls."
"What happened?"
"We were assigned to the Colombian army, who were identifying and destroying cocaine labs in the jungle. The Colombian army isn't great in the jungle.
He chuckled softly.
Actually, they're fuck all use at pretty much everything. Plus, the army leaks like a sieve. As soon as the troops know which area they're searching, the cartel is tipped off. So they would send us in, and we do the location and targeting and calling and airstrike or send in choppers so they could get there before the cartel knew what was happening. We were in two-man teams. We'd go in, and once we found a lab, we'd lie up in an observation post and then call it in. We were on a three-month attachment, and generally it worked well. And what happened with Hurst? We've only really got his word for it, and I'm not sure if we got the full story. We're about 10 miles apart and in radio contact. Me and a guy called Rusty had found a large processing factory and had set up an OP. All good. We stopped using the radio because we were dug in, pissing in plastic bags and the like. Hurst was with Ronnie Goldman, Goldilocks.
I remember Ronnie, said the Major. He killed himself, right?
The regiment had more than its fair share of suicides. Post-traumatic stress disorder was a common problem, and many men had trouble adapting to civvy street after an adrenaline-fueled career with the SAS.
A few months after he got back from Columbia, yeah? Said Peckham. In a nutshell, anyway, Marty and Ronnie got caught, not by the Colombian cartel, but by a Mexican group. The Mexicans were making inroads into the cocaine business in Colombia, and they were always getting into scraps with the Colombians. They were vicious bastards. If they felt that the Colombians were in what they regarded as their territories, they'd move in and skin everyone alive and hang their bodies from the trees. So they caught Marty and Ronnie, and normally they'd just have been killed and buried in the jungle. But for some reason, they were kept alive and tortured, mentally and physically. Fake executions, water torture, the works. Rusty and I didn't know they had a problem because we weren't using the radio. So, we call in our location and they send in choppers to destroy the factory and arrest as many of the workers as they could. It was a good bust. They got 2 Russian chemists and several tons of coke. Job well done. Then we realise that Marty and Ronnie had gone missing. The Colombians went looking and found them eventually in a Mexican camp. They went in with guns blazing. A lot of them got killed, but they found our guys. They were flying back to Hereford a few days later. They were in a pretty bad state, mentally more than physically. I'm sure that's why Ronnie topped himself.
But Marty was okay.
I wasn't that close to him, truth be told, but he left the regiment sometime afterwards, right? The rumour was that he'd been told he was being RTU'd, but had decided to quit instead. Can't say I blame him.
Did you talk to Ronnie about what had happened in the jungle?
Ronnie was a taciturn fucker at the best of times, boss, if you'll excuse my French. But he wouldn't say a word about what had happened out there. Just that they had been picked up by a patrol and beasted something rotten.
How did he kill himself?
Ah, it wasn't put down as suicide. He was out drinking and he was driving back to Sterling Lines when he hit a lamppost. He wasn't wearing his seatbelt and they reckon he died instantly.
So it was an accident.
He had a wife and 2 kids. The investigators bent over backwards to say that it was an accident brought on by a drink. But he'd left a note in the barracks about his will and what he wanted doing with his personal stuff. His mate found the note, but he didn't tell the cops, and the coroner was never told about it.
I get it, said the Major.
He thanked the trooper and ended the call. He took a gulp of coffee and bolted down the rest of his sandwich, deep in thought.